supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Virginia at noon today. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a fascinating topic, a frequently asked question for our Question of the Week feature. What do you do when tree roots appear above ground? Just in general, what about when they're growing up out of a lawn? And what about these city trees that move the pavement around wherever they want it? What's the correct response when tree roots become above ground roots? We'll tell you all you need to know to correct those problems and more when we get to the question of the week. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're going to take that heap and helping of your telecommunicated you-know-whats at 1-888-346-9499. Amy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Amy. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you.
Good.
And where is Amy good?
Royersford, Pennsylvania.
Very good. And what can we do for Amy in Royersford?
Well, we didn't know that we were inheriting a swamp at the very back of our backyard when we bought the house over the summer months. And we've been here a couple of years now, and now we know why there was no privacy screen of trees or anything, because we get all the water from all the surrounding houses. They all kind of converge in our yard. And we looked into many options with landscapers doing something about the water, even through the township, as, you know, this isn't right, we shouldn't have to deal with it. But basically, unless we spend an astronomical amount of money, we're going to have in the fall months and in the spring months a very wet backyard, and in the summer months a very dry backyard. But we are trying to create something nice to look at back there. So after researching myself and talking to many different landscapers, many swore that green giant arborvitaes will do well in any condition.
No.
Yeah.
You were doing good there. You were doing good there, but now you're grasping at straws. It always takes people a while to realize they might be facing a close to impossible situation. And when you do that, it's probably better to say, you know what, we can't grow anything in this backyard under these conditions, instead of grasping at straws. You might be able to grow cypress back there.
And we actually did put in the green giants, and they are growing, but they are a very strange color compared to the other green giants on the side of our yard where water isn't a problem. And they're kind of like a yellow-brown. They look dead, but when you go up to them, they're actually getting taller, but they're not getting any thicker. They look real scrawny.
If you dug them up, their roots would look like your feet after 3 months in water with no respite. This is unkind to the plants. And besides, they're not pleasant to look at.
So no, they're not.
You have a couple of options here. One is to bite the bullet and truly have the backyard regraded and have drain tiles installed. Drain tiles are actually almost a form of piping that carries the water away.
Okay, see, the problem is we have nowhere to put the water.
You're the lowest spot in the lowest place.
Exactly, and no access to drainage.
Your other option is to change the focus of your search for horticulture into a search for a rain garden. Now, you can read up on rain gardens online. You can go to our website and click on Questions of the Week, A to Z Garden Answers. You can go to R for rain garden. It'll give you a little primer on it. But all of the state extension services have vast amounts of information on this.
Okay.
It is perhaps the best way to handle a situation like yours where flooding is a seasonal event. And in short, what would happen is your yard would be regraded subtly to tend to take all the water down to one central area where you would install a pond or a bog. And inside the bog or the pond, you would have water plants that thrive. And the pond would be constructed in a way that would keep it wet all year long. On the outskirts of the pond, you would have what are called marginal plants, plants that exist on the margins of wetlands. You will find that if this is done correctly, if you spend your time up front, if you do your homework and the rain garden is graded and constructed correctly, it will dry out a lot more of your land. And once you get a certain distance away from the water feature, then you can plant whatever you want there to some degree, and it will do much better than in your soil that never dries out. All right, Ames, so, I mean, I know it seems like a big pain, but the rain garden is the best answer for you. People invest a lot in landscaping. Your investment is going to pay off a lot bigger than their landscaping because it's going to take care of a real serious problem you have. So research it well, build it well, and I think you'll be very happy.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, David. Where are you, sir?
Cincinnati, Ohio.
Excellent. Good to hear from you. What can we do for David from Cincinnati?
Well, we're just taking over a new yard in the city with lots of woods in the back, so plenty of good raw material for composting. But I have a question. My wife and I drink an awful lot of tea. We spend an awful lot of tea leaves. Are these something I can put in with the compost, or have they got so much tannin that they're going to inhibit the composting?
No, I can't imagine that. I'm a real fan of loading up a compost pile that's mostly shredded leaves with coffee grounds. And they can be very powerful, both in their acidity and their nutrient levels, but that's one of the joys of composting is it, if done correctly, it tends to bring everything back to center. Now, do you have a lot of shredded fall leaves to get yourself started for this season?
Pretty good start, and in the future will be almost unlimited amounts available. So.
And the leaves are shredded?
Well, yeah.
Good. And so do you have a pile going?
Yeah, a little bit, and as I say, we just started it, so next year we'll have a more extensive section. We've also got a couple of huge magnolias in our front, but I'm weaving those leaves out, and I understand they're very difficult to convert.
Well, yes, that is magnolia leaves, oak leaves, a lot of the leaves that people have in abundance down south. A lot of times we're getting into a leaf that's thicker and more fibrous than something like, you know, my maples and tulip poplars and things like that. So, you know, for instance, you may have to pass those leaves twice through the shredding process that you use for your other leaves. If it's one of those big shredders you drop the leaves into, if it's a leaf blower set on reverse, or if you're running over them with your lawnmower, they may take a couple of extra runs. But they shouldn't be wasted. They're organic matter. They will contribute to the composting. When you really shred them fine, then they won't slow down the composting process at all.
Just give them an extra go over.
Right. And it just becomes a not so much common sense after a while, but you get a feel for it. You know how nobody's good at anything that when they do it the first time. And you feel awkward, you never want to paint a room again or help anybody else with carpentry, but the need keeps arising. And then you turn around and 10 years down the line, somebody compliments you on your abilities, and it's true. You rarely note when you've become good at something. So every year you compost, especially early on, you get a little bit better at fine-tuning your materials, your backyard. It's kind of something, it's very organic, obviously, in every way, and it's something you lean into. So we got shredded leaves. We're going to have a load of tea bags. What else is going in?
Well, just, you know, plenty of vegetable leftovers to go in there, too. So.
Well, take my advice now. This is the hardest part for people to wrap their heads around. Nature has very fertile ground where fallen leaves have disintegrated and dead spent plants have returned to the soil. Nature does not have large garbage dumps.
Yeah.
And you need at least 80% leaves,
right,
to balance out any kitchen waste you put in there.
Yeah, we generate more vegetable waste than we can use. It would be overkill, right?
Well, I would also advise you to get an indoor worm bin.
Now, there's an idea.
And utilize them to process, let's say, half your kitchen waste, especially the stuff that takes a long time in the compost pile. Those worms will create a fabulous fertilizer for you from kitchen waste alone. And a lot of people, as they get older and they're not willing or able to collect and shred the leaves anymore, but they still want compost for their containers or their house plants, they turn to worm bins to recycle their kitchen waste. And I tell you, a worm will make better compost out of your kitchen leftovers than will happen in a compost pile. Those worms are absolutely magical in the nutrients they can impart to stuff that didn't have a lot of fertilizing potential on the way into the worm.
All right. Well, we'll do that as well. We won't need to waste anything.
All right,
thanks,
David.
Much.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that out-of-town listeners planning to visit the famed Philadelphia Flower Show might want to consider making Wednesday, March 9th their target date, as weekdays are much less crowded than weekends, and I'll deliver my annual rollicking flower show lecture at 12:30 on Wednesday, March 9th. But don't go looking for all the dates and details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do when tree toes start poking out above ground. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
You're listening to WHYY.
That's Jake Shimabukuro, virtuoso ukulele player. I'm Marty Moscowen. He's going to be our guest for a special concert and conversation this Monday at 11 on Radio Times. To reserve your seat, go to whyy.org/member experience. See you there.
Hey, why don't you check out newsworks.org today? There's a video essay about a group of volunteers who go underground, literally, to count Philadelphia's homeless. Fascinating story at Newsworks.
WHYY programming is supported by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. We are PSEA, providing the power of a great education.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a fascinating topic, a frequently asked question for our Question of the Week feature. What do you do when tree roots appear above ground? Just in general, what about when they're growing up out of a lawn? And what about these city trees that move the pavement around wherever they want it? What's the correct response when tree roots become above ground roots? We'll tell you all you need to know to correct those problems and more when we get to the question of the week. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're going to take that heap and helping of your telecommunicated you-know-whats at 1-888-346-9499. Alex, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Alex. How are you?
Nice to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, Alex. Where are you?
I'm in South Philadelphia.
Okay, good. What can we do you for?
Well, I was calling because I had started the worm composting about 6 months ago.
Good for you.
In the spring, I wanted to do a small garden, but my backyard doesn't really get full light at any point because of the overgrown trees and weeds.
Right.
So I had wanted to maybe do window boxes for a garden.
Excellent.
And I was looking at, I guess, sort of, how do I use my worm compost? Do I mix it together with soil or just use that? And I wanted to kind of get suggestions for different plants that would go well together in the boxes to create something that I could use, you know, to cook from.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, do you have your boxes?
My boxes for my garden?
Yeah.
No, I didn't get the window boxes yet.
Okay. Now, you're going to use these year after year, and
yes.
and you have windows to hang them from.
Yes, probably four usable windows.
Oh, okay, good. Make sure when you get your window boxes that they are a good, durable material that's going to last for many years. People love the look of wooden window boxes, but they're mm-hmm. going to rot out pretty quickly and need to be replaced on a regular basis.
Okay.
Stone, terracotta, sometimes you can find these, but they're very heavy to hang from a window.
Yeah.
And, of course, they would crack if you left them out in the wintertime. So even though I don't like it as a substance, plastic tends to work very well in these situations. Make sure there's good drainage holes in the bottom. Drainage is essential for any container. Once you have your window boxes, once you got good drainage in them, I want you to go to a garden center. I want you to get a big bag of what's called soil-free mix. This may be called professional mix. It may be called potting soil. They're made from milled peat moss with a little lime to adjust the pH. Substances that drain well, like vermiculite and perlite, and some compost or composted forest products. And you don't want anything that has chemical fertilizer in it. Read them carefully. Shop around and you can avoid those.
Okay.
Now, nothing in the bottom of your window boxes other than the soil-free mix and your worm castings. Don't put anything in the bottom for drainage. These mixes drain well. You can either take your worm castings and mix them in with your soil-free mix at the rate of about 10 to 20% worm castings. They're very rich. They're very nutritious. They'll add some nice substance to the soil. You can also fill the containers with soil-free mix most of the way. Put in a couple layers of worm castings, and then cover that with more soil-free mix. Just don't let the worm castings sit on the top by themselves, or some of their nutrition will be lost to the air. And then the plants that you put in them, I think, are going to be pretty obvious. If you have these container boxes up early in the season, you definitely want to put pansies in them.
Okay.
Pansies will flourish in all but the hottest weather, and they are pretty. They love being in containers, and they're also edible. So when you make your salads, you can put some pansy flowers on top of your salads, and they're very good for you. They're very tasty. They make a salad very colorful. Also, early in the season, I would directly seed lettuces, cutting lettuces, into some of the boxes. And then when you're ready for a salad, you just go out with a pair of scissors and your salad spinner, cut the lettuces into the salad spinner directly. Don't pull them. Don't harvest them completely. Leave an inch behind on top of the roots, and they will regrow for a couple of runs, again, until the weather gets really warm. Then when the weather gets too hot for lettuce and pansies, I would replace those with the herbs of your choice, annual herbs, not perennial herbs, that you like, and maybe a couple of pepper plants as well. Peppers do very well in containers. You want small fruited peppers if you're going to get bell peppers. If you like hot peppers, almost any hot pepper plant will stay well behaved and be very ornamental. And then I would also suggest in at least one of the boxes you just have some fun and put in some petunias. There is a type of petunia called the wave petunia that's designed for hanging boxes and hanging baskets, and it trails down, and it's you know, it's not edible, but it's what the Pennsylvania Dutch call just for nice.
Okay.
All right.
Yep, that sounds great. Thank you so much.
Good luck on your upcoming great adventure.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I enjoy listening to your show.
Well, thank you. Where are you, man?
I'm down east in lower Delaware, about 10 miles from the ocean and about 7 or 8 miles west of the Delaware Bay.
Okay.
In Lewis, Delaware.
Right, which uneducated people call Lewes.
Yeah, there's a lot of conjecture about that, and I can't tell you which is correct, but that's all what I know about it.
Well, I can, because I've used the ferry many times, and all the captains agree there is no Cape May Lewis ferry. There is only a ferry that goes from Cape May to Lewes, Delaware. All right, what can we do for John in Lewes, Delaware?
I have some sequoia tree seedlings that I bought from a company out in McKinley, California.
Right.
The original one is about 4 feet tall, and the newer ones are about a foot to a foot and a half tall. Now, I have mushroom soil compost that I bought in bags up Pennsylvania and mushroom country a couple of years ago. Now, what I have in mind to do is spread that around the perimeter of the tree seedlings so that the soil doesn't dry out so quickly during the hot summertime.
I don't like this idea. There's just something about it that is nagging at me. These plants, which people are often surprised to find can survive in our area, these things that, you know, eventually over thousands of years can become massive trees, they don't know from mushroom soil, and they typically grow in a very nutrient poor environment and fairly sandy soil. As well. Now, you say you have sandy soil,
yes.
And these trees have been in the ground, some of them, for several years?
Yes. The youngest one is in now, going on to the second year, and the older one is about 3 or 4 years in the ground.
And have you fed them anything up to this point?
No. Just when I mow the grass, they get wet grass clippings fly out of the mower.
Okay, I don't like that either. Now, these trees, as you know, in nature, exist in very sandy, very nutrient-poor soils. With mushroom soil, can be a mixed bag. Sometimes it's very salty, sometimes it's kind of alkaline. And these trees have been doing okay, right? They look good?
Except when it gets to be the very hottest, driest part of the summer, they show some stress.
Okay, very good, very good, because they come from a much more temperate area. And they are used to being misted naturally with fog. That's how they get a lot of their moisture,
right.
the sequoias and the redwoods. So I would not use the mushroom soil on them, especially if it's been sitting in the bags for several years. It's probably gone anaerobic. What I would do is I would empty that mushroom soil out of the bag in the spring, pile it all up somewhere, and let it compost down till around midsummer, and then spread it around some other plants.
Oh, okay.
For the sequoia trees, I would find a nice collection of pine needles, if I could find them, fallen pine needles, like from a white pine.
Right.
And I would spread those as a mulch an inch deep. Or shredded fall leaves that are really well shredded, they would make a great moisture conserving mulch, because I think that part is correct. I think you do want to help them have a more regular source of moisture in the soil. Even yard waste compost that is made from mostly fall leaves, I wouldn't mind an inch of that on the surface of the soil. Although an inch or two of pine needles, straw, or shredded fall leaves is going to be a much better conservator of moisture. And I wouldn't be afraid, if it's possible for you to do it, to give them some supplemental moisture once a week in the torrid parts of the summertime to help them get by.
Right. Right.
Now the grass clippings, you must have noticed that, you know, when you pile them up and it rains, they turn into a slimy black mess. Those grass clippings are all right as mulch if you take them somewhere first and dry them out, spread them out in the sun to dry until they lose their green color and turn brown. Then they would make a perfectly acceptable mulch for your sequoias. I think you're on the right track. So don't be afraid to give them some water when temperatures are ridiculously high. Pick one of the three natural mulches we talked about. Use the mushroom soil somewhere else. And, you know, hopefully these sequoias will continue to grow and thrive. And a couple hundred years from now, somebody will go, where did these things come from?
Well, thank you very much. I enjoy your program.
Very good. Thank you, John.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Dwayne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing? It's an honor.
I'm doing very well. Dwayne, the honor's all mine. Where are you, man?
It's called Elk Garden, Virginia. It's a little bit north of Abington, Virginia, in the Appalachian southwestern part of Virginia.
Okay, good. What can we do for you, Dwayne?
I run a grass-fed, grass-finished cattle company, and a resource that we have plenty of is some manure straw compost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've been doing this for about 2 years now, and I'm not sure if it's a problem. And I'm originally from PA, actually, up in Lancaster County. And I see the Amish using raw manure on all their gardening almost all the time. But, you know, we're using this manure compost, and there's still raw manure in it. And I'm wondering if there's maybe something I'm doing wrong or if there's a more efficient way to use it. My intuition says it's a problem, but, you know, the Amish obviously didn't seem to have a problem with it.
Well, I can tell you right away that no one should be using raw manure of any form in any form of farming and gardening. For instance, in organic agriculture or agriculture that's certified organic, you're not allowed to use raw manure. It must be composted. Now, my experience with cow manure, which is the closest we're getting with you, is that it's very liquidy and loose, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
See, because with horse manure, it's much easier to pile it up somewhere and compost it. And as everybody who's done this knows, the big stinky pile of horse manure very quickly becomes a giant pile of what looks like rich black soil. The advantage to your cow manure is that it is well balanced, believe it or not. The nice thing about cow manure, and I would think steer manure would be very close to the same, is that it's not very powerful in terms of its fertilizing potential, but it is well balanced. So this is a darn good manure. I guess the big issue is, now you say you're collecting it with bedding.
Yes, we use, you know, what we're cleaning out of their stalls, and we pile it up. We get a really good pile of compost, you know, throughout the summer and spring.
My suggestion would be if there is a lot of the brown material that you're using to make the bottom of the stall safe, whether it's hay or sawdust or wood shavings, if you can actually move it out of there and pile it up somewhere, I would imagine it would compost down and turn into a black soil-like substance, right?
Yeah, I mean, we do pull it out of there and put it in a big pile, but what we find is, you know, there is still pockets of green manure.
I'll tell you what the big boys do here is they set up a system where they can go in with machines and turn the compost, simply move it around. And this doesn't have to be done every day, but with the equivalent of a front-end loader or some other kind of device, just break the pile open, move it around. The goal with any composting material, and you've got what you need here. You've got the carbon from the stuff that's on the floor to keep the stall clean and non-slippery, and you've got the nitrogen from the actual manure. But I tell you, if you keep it in a big pile and break up that pile two or three times a month and move it around, at the end of about 2 months, anytime in spring, summer, or fall, that batch should be done. And it can be moved off to another area to be trucked away and sold or applied to fields, and a new one can be started. You should be fine. The only thing I would have it checked for is salt content, because sometimes, because of the way we feed these animals, although you say they're grass-fed, they're free-range, right?
Yeah, they don't get nothing in their diet other than grass and hay. So
I want your compost, man. I want your composted steer manure. I would put it on my garden. I would use it around my vegetables and my flowers. Just do your best. Make sure it gets composted as much as you can get it done.
So you're saying just flip it often, more often, and because I'm flipping about once a month, maybe, and it takes a lot longer than 2 months to get it.
Yes, then we need to be flipping more and maybe making the individual piles bigger.
Okay, great.
All right, Dwayne?
Hey, I appreciate that.
My pleasure. Good luck, sir.
Hey, thank you very much.
Take care.
Yep, bye.
All right, it's time for me to take a little break and suggest that listeners whose gardens are being pummeled by ice and snowstorms, like mine, consider delaying any winter pruning chores until spring. Our plants are going to suffer some inevitable winter damage this year. If we leave them alone now, we'll be able to just prune off those winter damage sections in the spring without accidentally exposing lower parts of the plant to even more winter damage now. But don't you go hiding the pruners from helpful hubbies just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do when tree roots come above ground. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
This is WHYY, 34 degrees in Center City at 11:38.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. I'll have a busy weekend when I appear at the Capital Home and Garden Show at the Dulles Expo Center in Chantilly, Virginia on Friday, February 25th, then hop quick like a bunny back to our area to appear on Saturday and Sunday, the 26th and 27th, at the Suburban Home and Garden Show at the Expo Center in Oaks, PA. The Philadelphia International Flower Show opens on Sunday, March 6th and runs through Sunday, March 13th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in Center City, Philly. This year's theme is Springtime in Paris, and I'll deliver my annual lecture at the Flower Show at 12:30 on Wednesday, March 9th. All of the lectures and workshops are free with Flower Show admission. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
On today's Fresh Air Weekend, we talk about sports concussions. Christopher Nowinski is a Harvard-educated former wrestler whose own head injuries led him to study the brains of dead football players. Nowinski is president of the Sports Legacy Institute, a nonprofit working to fight brain trauma in athletes. Fresh Air Weekend at 1 today on WHYY. The forecast for today, it's a rainy day, the high about 39. Tonight, few showers about, mostly cloudy, the low 32. Sunday, sunshine for the most part, had a high of 39 for Sunday. Monday, cloudy with a high 45. Right now, it's 34 degrees.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens, in just a few short minutes, as opposed to those agonizing long minutes. We'll get to the question of the week and tell you what to do when tree roots come above ground, when they invade your lawn, and when they start messing with the pavement outside your house. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sherry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing good today. Sher, how are you?
I'm doing great.
And where is Sherry doing great?
I am in Jobstown, New Jersey, which is in Burlington County, real close to Fort Dix.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Sherry in Jobstown?
Well, I moved here about 2.5 years ago, and I've been playing around with the best place to put my garden. And I want to move it across the yard because where I put it last year was a little bit too shady, and I also have a big problem with bamboo. We've tried to kill the bamboo in many ways, but what I was thinking is that if we just can't kill it, would it be a good idea to make my garden in a raised bed and put lots of newspaper down on the bottom and peat moss and lots of organic material, and then plant on top of that? Or would the bamboo just come right up through it?
Are you kidding? I see a horror movie where the hero is running through a cornfield and all of a sudden giant metal spikes are coming up out of the ground all over the place. You can't stop bamboo.
Oh.
Bamboo is the squirrel of the horticultural world. It is the inevitable winner of most conflicts. Even if you poured concrete over top, it would probably start pushing up the concrete sooner or later. Now, whose bamboo is this?
I believe it was planted by the previous owner here.
Oh, that's the worst. So it's on your property and you didn't do it.
Right.
Bamboo can be stopped, but there's a couple of different ways to do it. If it is still in a dedicated area and it has not yet invaded the area you want your garden to be, I would advise you to bite the bullet and put in a barrier.
Okay.
Now, bamboo cannot cross running water. I believe it has part vampire in its blood. So some people, if they have the layout for it, the inclination, they actually come in, they have somebody come in with a trench digger, dig a trench as if they were laying a deep water pipe, but then create siding and materials to make a water feature that is essentially a canal, like a long, narrow water feature that will then look deliberate. You'll have this long thing of water in your garden attracting birds and frogs and toads, and you can plant some water plants in there that would come up, that would grow right up out of the canal itself. But the bamboo would not be able to cross that line. Especially if the canal was built deep enough.
How deep do you mean?
You'd have to do some research. I don't want a freehand bamboo.
Okay.
But you will find, for instance, if you go to our website, go to You Bet Your Garden, go to Garden Answers A to Z, go to B for bamboo. We have a lot of warnings and information about this and links to the American Bamboo Society, who have all the technology about planting depths and stuff like that. The other option is what's called rhizome barrier. One of the issues with your bamboo is you can look out and see maybe 100 different plants out there, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's one plant.
Okay.
That is one single plant growing from one gigantic root system called a rhizome, and it creeps sideways like the rhizomes of sun-loving grasses. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's always constantly advancing. People who want bamboo as an ornamental feature but know its tenacity will have what's called a rhizome barrier installed. That's where a thinner trench is dug and this specialized material is buried in the ground and laid in at just the right angles with a lip coming up and sides coming out so that the bamboo stops when it gets to that barrier. It's very effective. And it's also well known. I mean, there's a lot of bamboo out there, so a lot of rhizome barriers have to be erected. Other than that, you know, people have a backhoe come in and just take it all out. It's a huge expense, but then they get to re-landscape. You can also just cut it back for season after season for a couple of seasons, and then try, once it starts sprouting like a little bit of grass, then you can try killing it with a high-strength vinegar over the course of a summer. But I tell you, if it's confined at this point, I would install the water feature or a rhizome barrier because, you know, it's beautiful. The bamboo itself is a fabulous plant. So if you can stop it advancing into the areas you don't want it, you can have your bamboo in garden, too.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your help.
Okay, so read that question of the week, learn about bamboo, see what your options are. You can really turn this into a positive.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cher.
All right, take care.
1-888-346-9499. Robin, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, it's good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you. Robin, where are you?
I'm calling from Yellow Springs, Ohio. That's near Dayton in southwest Ohio.
Yes, yes, yeah. We used to get a lot of calls from Yellow Springs.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
those Daytonites kind of elbowed you guys out of the way. Is there some sort of little crosstown rivalry going on there?
Oh, no. We're pretty close.
They're aggressive, those Daytonites.
Yeah,
aren't
they are.
They?
Well, I'm calling about growing vegetables in containers.
Okay.
I've been doing this for many years, and I was very successful with it, but I only did 3 pots or so. The last couple years, I started adding more pots because I liked it so much, and the last 2 years, I had a dozen pots that hold about 20 to 25 gallons of soil in them, and that's a lot of soil. I made it out of about one-third my own compost and two-thirds soilless potting mix, a good professional mix.
Huh, good.
And it required about 250 cubic feet of soil, which was very, very expensive and a lot of work. And the tomatoes, most of the vegetables did very well, but the tomatoes also developed some kind of leaf blotch stuff.
What kind of containers are we talking about?
Well, actually, I've been using smart pots. They're kind of a cloth material that is supposed to breathe.
You may be talking to one of the only, quote, garden writers in America who knows what smart pots are.
I love them.
The people, I'm just shocked you found them.
Yeah. It was a lot of searching on the internet. They're more popular now. I noticed they're in the garden catalogs. But
well, these have been used for quite a while by professionals to raise bare root trees and stuff like that. And you have no in-ground space? Or
No, I have a small yard. It's only about a third of an acre with a ranch house on it, and it's surrounded by black walnut trees.
Oh, smart. Okay, so you're
and
doing
so
the right
I
thing.
Don't, even my compost, I only use the leaves from one part of the yard because I don't want to, and the compost actually doesn't have many leaves in it.
What's in it?
Well, I grow a lot of houseplants, and so it's spent soil from those. And the little bit of soil from the vegetables I grow, like cucumbers and beans, that I don't think will have disease in it, I
right.
throw back in the compost pile.
Yeah, but I don't think there's much nutrition in it.
That may be true.
Yeah.
That may be true.
I think we're kind of bankrupt here. I would actually recommend you look into having a worm bin indoors to make worm castings over the winter and throughout the year from the kitchen garbage. That would be a tremendous addition to your regimen. Now, your tomatoes, what did they look like? Tell me what went wrong.
Well, it's similar to what I've heard you describe on air. It starts at the bottom of the plant with the little yellow circles on the leaves, and then they spread it, and they get
and
dark
it moves
brown
up
and they
the
die.
Plant. Okay, yeah. You have totally described verticillium wilt. The only thing you need to concentrate on is you don't grow tomatoes in a pot that grew tomatoes the previous year.
Oh.
But it sounds like one of the things you're doing is growing tomatoes in the same soil year after year, and that's the soil, for instance, that if you're out of rotation, that's when you dump that stuff off somewhere. Don't be afraid to let that sit somewhere in your property, that soil, and sit for a year or two in compost. It will begin to lose the verticillium, and then you can go back to it a few years down the line.
Oh, I thought it would have lost all its nutrients as well.
I don't think you had that many nutrients in it to begin with.
I grew great tomatoes. They were beautiful.
But in the meantime, now pay special attention. Limit the number of pots that have tomatoes in them. And then the next year, you can grow tomatoes in all the other pots and move your other crops like string beans and peppers and even potatoes into the pots that had tomatoes. Your problems will be minimal. It really is tomatoes, where this rotation is just absolutely essential. All right, Rob?
Thank you very much. I'll do better next year.
Oh, we all do better next year. That's the whole point of gardening. There's
right.
always next year. Gardening and baseball.
Thank you.
All right, Rob.
Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Dealing with above-ground tree roots. We lead off with Ray in Oklahoma City, who writes, I have a Bradford pear tree. It's about 25 years old. Roots are showing themselves above ground, about 3 feet from the trunk, and they're getting larger. What causes this? And is it possible to tear them out without harming the tree? Maybe it wasn't planted deep enough to begin with? Thanks. Well, many types of trees develop surface roots naturally, and, quote, tearing out those roots would likely kill the tree. Planting depth is not the problem. In fact, deep planting stresses trees by burying part of the trunk below ground, where it's subject to bark-killing rot. You should always plant a tree high enough in the ground that the root flare is showing. That's how nature does it, after all. Just look in the woods. Bury it deep and you will have a really expensive problem to deal with years down the line. For the many solutions, we move on to an email from Dick and Phyllis in Hokesing, Delaware. We have many trees whose roots have spread out over the surface of the yard. The grass in those areas has died out. We'd like to get it back. The local lawn service told us we'd have to remove the trees to get grass to grow in those places. We don't consider this an option. Can we cut off the roots that have come to the surface and replant the grass without killing the trees? Well, as I detailed in a previous question of the week we devoted to growing grass under trees, the problems in this coexistence are complex. First, there are only a few varieties of grass that can survive the dense shade of a tree canopy. Fine fescue comes to mind for your region of the country, and these grasses can't take much, if any, foot traffic. There are also clumping grasses that need to be reseeded or overseeded in the fall, sometimes yearly, to keep them full. Ah, but many experts feel that the intense competition for food and moisture is even more of a limiting effect than that shade. Big trees have big efficient roots that tend to take all the water in the area for themselves, and feeding a lawn over top of those roots is perhaps the perfect way to deliver most of the food to the tree instead of the lawn. In short, lawns under trees are always going to be problematic at best and will require much more care than a lawn in sun or even a shady lawn that doesn't have trees giving it in a wedgie and stealing its lunch money. That's why the areas under trees in nature tend to be bare, covered with roots, or dotted with tough and scrappy little plants. But if deterred by my warnings, you are not. Have the area covered in 1 to 2 inches of high-quality yard waste compost or a mix of compost and screened high-quality topsoil. Then seed fine fescue into this as close to August 15th as possible to give the new grass time to establish before the fall leaves drop. Don't try and sow a cool season lawn in spring or summer, and make sure any topsoil you buy is dark in color when it's dry. Unlike whacking away at them, covering the roots with some soil won't harm the trees a bit. And if you're willing to give the grass extra food and water, stay off it as much as possible, and overseed it every fall or so, it could well work nicely. But it would be much less work to cover the roots with a mix of topsoil and peat moss for added acidity, and then establish a colony of mosses under the trees. High-quality mosses are available in the form of sod, plugs, and spreadable powders, can be started in the spring, never need cutting or feeding, just supplemental water and maybe a little help staying acidic. They're green all year long, and they are a perfectly natural ground cover under trees, if you get my hint. We conclude with a question from Robert in Havertown, PA. Who writes, a large, healthy, shade-providing tulip poplar is lifting the sidewalk in front of my home. This sidewalk has broken at the seam, and one of the blocks has been raised a couple inches. Can I remedy this situation without harming the root and the tree? Am I doomed to making repeated repairs to the sidewalk? Can I trick the root into going into another direction? Thanks for any help. This tree deserves to be saved. Well, first, a warning. Tulip poplars are fast-growing but relatively short-lived trees. Towards the end of their life, they become brittle and have a nasty habit of dropping large and potentially deadly limbs down upon the unsuspecting human head. So when yours begins to display this bad habit, plan to have it removed quickly. Until that time, however, you may indeed continue to enjoy its ample shade. Now, the easiest answer here is to remove the affected portions of the walkway permanently and reconstruct the area to accommodate a bigger planter effect at the base of the tree, perhaps using a nice wrought iron something or other as an accent and a visual reminder that there ain't no sidewalk in that spot anymore. And I happen to know for a fact, because I did it successfully some 20 years ago, that you can have an experienced arborist sever a wayward root or two on these monsters without any ill effect. So if it is just one big bad root causing the majority of the problems, a small rootectomy may also be in order. Well, that sure was some interesting information about above-ground tree roots now, wasn't it? Luckily, yous can stroll through the print version of the Question of the Week at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to prune my bad roots if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live and put the actual subject in the subject line. Not question for Mike, hello, or even hello, sailor. Or check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, just like yours, hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of garden answers, hint, hint, look there first, hint, hint, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Rich Banowitz is our webmaster. His assistant, Sarah Kazar, rules this savage land. Our intern, Jessica Mandick, never makes a mess above ground. The also well-behaved Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. On the other hand, our editor, Al Banks, looks like he could use a little root pruning. I'm busting up the sidewalk, Mike McGrath, and I'll see you. Gardeners who failed to gather fall leaves, or who live where there are none, often turn to paper as a compost pile ingredient. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to best use paper in the garden, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike helps us out of this severe and snowy winter with dreams of his